Osiris.
Jam. I'm your host, Jonathan Shank. We're exploring the evolution of jam through the lens of key genres, events, and moments, its connection to the mainstream as told by artists, industry icons, and tastemakers. Today, I'm thrilled and honored to be joined by a legendary bass player, one of my favorite all-time musicians, a progenitor of funk, someone who has collaborated with everybody from Dr. John to Paul McCartney to the Rolling Stones and Jimmy Buffett. Today, we'll be talking about his influences, his beginnings, his accolades, and all of his unbelievable collaborations. Please welcome the man who has funkified your life, my friend, George Porter Jr. It's so good to see you, George. Thanks for being here. Can't believe here we are on the jam, and thanks so much. How you doing, man? What's going on down there?
How you say it? I'm doing real well. Thanks for the invite. You know, how you say it? I always like kind of open with saying that I'm growing old gracefully.
Man, well, we've known one another a long time, and I'm excited to just get into this with you and go deep and go to the deep end, as they say. So, you know, take me back to the beginnings. What were some of your earliest musical influences?
Well, you know, being from New Orleans, you know, I kind of got, I guess my earliest memory of getting music would be from the street, you know, hearing, you know, the brass bands because of the relationship with my house to this social pleasure club was like a block and a half away. And there were older guys in there. And so, they, you know, probably almost twice a month, man, they was losing some guys, you know. So there was always a serious second line that happened when it passed right in front of my house, you know. So between that and the music that was getting played inside my house, which, you know, my dad was very, very into the tenor players and, you know, from the old school and the organ players. So I got, you know, I got to hear, you know, the kind of mostly the bebop jazz, you know.
A lot of jazz influence.
Yeah. You know, but it was probably, you know, my mom was in singing in the Catholic school choir, and the choir director, Gus Loten was his name, you know, suggested that, you know, that she should get her boys into music, you know, that's going to keep them off the streets, you know, and keep them out of danger. He just never got professional. He didn't know how much music trouble you can get in professional. So my mom got myself and my little brother violins, which was really a bad mistake. You know, she brought these things home once. It was like a Tuesday or Wednesday, something like that. And my dad hadn't gotten home from work yet. And when my dad got home from work, me and my brother were sitting in the back. We didn't finish our homework. We was in the back. And boy, my pop lost it, man. He said, "What the hell?"
Those were the seeds right there.
he said, "Nah, that's got to go. That's got to get out of here." You know. So the violins went away. And at that point, now she had kind of somewhat sparks, you know, a little spark, you know. And Zig's brother, older brother Clinton, played piano. And well, he was actually a violinist. He was a violinist in the New Orleans Symphony. And he played piano. And so she suggested, you know, she thought that maybe I can go and take piano lessons. So I took piano lessons from Clinton for about 3 weeks. But
And that's how you started hanging out with Zig around that time?
Well, that's when I first got to meet Zig.
And yeah.
You're your cousin, you know, your cousins, she would say, they're, you know, they're four blocks from us. You know, we stayed two blocks on Rabbit Street on the west side of Parish Prison, and Zig stayed three blocks on the east side of Parish Prison on the same street.
All right.
So, you know, basically five blocks apart from each other.
Neighbors.
And so, you know, I would walk down to his house and go to do my piano lessons. But because of the competition between Zig and myself, Ed Early, two Capricorns, and his older brother was teaching somebody else how to play the piano and wasn't teaching him how to play the piano, that caused enough confusion for his mom to say, cut this out. So this is the second instrument I got iced on, you know? And it was a few years later on my eighth birthday that my mom, my grandmother actually bought me a guitar, an acoustic guitar. And my mom got into a lot of trouble with my dad about the guitar because he thought that she had spent his money on buying an instrument that was, you know, that wasn't going to get me anywhere, you know, it was going to. And he was really upset about that, but he lived through it.
He got over it.
But at 8 years old, mom said the deal was that I had to take guitar lessons in order to keep
the guitar.
It was like a lease kind of thing. You know, you could lease to purchase, you know, and back then that's when they first came out with that. So I was 8 years old, and I agreed to taking the lessons. I didn't have a problem with learning. I was kind of a smart kid, and said learning, I didn't think I was gonna have a problem with that. So I went to lessons, but my lessons, my teacher was, because I had a gut head guitarist. So the first things he thought that I was going to be playing classical music. That's what I wanted to play. So he was teaching me the classical music formula, basically playing with all my fingers, and with the songs that he had me playing and reading, actually, because I was reading at the time, was country songs, country western, Home on the Range, Red River Valley.
Wow. You know?
Just because the simplicity of the songs will get you, you know, and I understand that years later, I understood what the reasoning behind that.
Yeah, that's a real discipline.
I heard Segovia later and I said, whoa, I ain't gonna never play like that.
Yeah. And you were able to carry that forward in what you were doing, on the bass years later. So I feel like that.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And so, at what point do you transition from guitar to bass?
Well, it was years later. When I saw Papi and his grandfather playing on the steps one of those Saturday mornings on my way to my lesson, I saw his grandfather playing. And he was playing, you know, St. Louis blues, you know, he was playing these blues thing, but he was using that classical formula. He was playing with all of these fingers on his right hand. You know, and not all of them, because he didn't use the last two, but he would play the thumb and the first two fingers, you know. And I said, man, that's the songs I want to play. I want to learn how to play those songs, not Red River Valley, not no cowboy songs, you know. So, but then when his grandfather passed away, I started going over by Papi's house and just hanging out with him and playing. So Papi was a bass player, basically, but that knew how to play guitar, and that's what was, it kind of run down to me is I was a guitar player that was learning through the classical formula how to play bass. So, because I was playing bass lines and all that anyway. So, you know, that was the way we went. That was the role. And I mean, I guess for the next probably 4 or 5 years, you know, just hanging out with Poppy and playing. I played in the Sanctified Church, a gospel church, playing sanctified music, you know. And we would switch off between guitar and bass. He would play guitar on a few songs, I'd play bass, and then I would switch off, I'd play some guitar. He would play bass on the songs that he thought was more fun.
I see, there was a system.
Yeah.
So, at a certain point, that leads to you starting to do sessions and you start working with Earl King. Is that, at what point does Earl King come into your life?
Earl King came into my life probably through my relationship with Poppy and yeah. Herbert Wing. Herbert Wing had a band called the Royal Knights. Mm-hmm. And used to play frat parties all the time on Broadway Street up there. And the frat parties back then, back in those days, they would hire a house band, and then they would hire different artists. So, you know, Earl King, Benny Spellman, Ernie Cato, Chris Kenner, you know, all of these guys. I never got to play with Chris Kenner.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all of those guys, you know, you would be in this on this gig. And I wasn't necessarily at that time on the gig. I just used to be. I used to hang with Herbert and Poppy. Anywhere Herbert Wing went, most likely you saw me. And so at any kind of musical event, then I was there because I would help. I was like, I would think I was New Orleans' first roadie.
Yeah.
And I was loading and setting up gear and stuff like that. And I played. And basically, I kind of went through all three of the instruments, the four instruments that they would have. And I played bass. I played drums. I played at the keyboard. And, you know, Herbert would never turn loose the guitar. You know, he was always the guitar player, but the drummer would get up and leave and run off somewhere. I would play drums for a couple of songs and he'd come back. The bass player would want to take a break. I would play bass, you know. So, you know, that's how I got my, you know, I got to play behind Earl King, you know, play behind Ernie Cato. I think I actually may have played behind Tommy Ridgely once. I definitely played behind Tommy Ridgely in Greece, you know, years later, you know. We went to Greece with, it was a version of the Running Partners band before we was actually Running Partners, but we was calling ourselves. So it was David Nasty's band without David Nasty. But the Taste of New Orleans that David, you know, David wanted to get paid as an artist, and the buyers wasn't interested in paying him as an artist, and you know, and so I would, you know, I asked him, I said, man, you know, they want me to, you know, man, want me to bring the band over, man. You okay with that? David said, man, yeah, go ahead and do it. You know? So I would go play those gigs, you know, and I would have David's band with different players, you know, and it'll be behind Tommy Ridgely and Earl King at that time when I took that to Greece. So that was real cool. I think we were actually in Athens.
Amazing. You know, there's a real appreciation for funk music in Europe and in Greece, and I've always loved that, been grateful for that.
But I mean, you know, back then it wasn't being called funk. You know, it was hard. They had a very large love for R&B music because that particular show that I was on in Athens was. The headliner was Curtis Mayfield, and so the first night we opened the show. Curtis played second, and the second night Curtis opened the show and we played second. And it was, you know, and it was beautiful, you know, the relationship that it was the party that we played for was called, it was the Greek Communist Party, I think it was. Youth
wow.
Communist.
Yeah.
The Greek Youth Communist Party. And man, they treated us like kings. I mean, we couldn't spend no money. Absolutely. They said, don't change no money. We don't need that, you know. You know, we took care of it. They took care of us like kings over there. It was beautiful.
That's amazing. So playing with Earl eventually leads to you meeting art or connecting further with art, right? And the idea of getting the meters together. Talk to me about those early days of getting the meters together and playing at Ivanhoe and what, you know, what those initial sessions and shows were like.
Well, in the beginning, it was I had moved on from Herbert and Papi and started playing with Walter Washington and actually on a thing with Walter was again it was one of those kind of things that I went to the 808, you know, just kind of you know, and I was actually 17 years old. I was too young to even be in there, but I was tall, wore dark sunglasses, had a James Brown hairdo, you know, and so the door person really didn't pay much attention, you know, and I stood by the side of the stage and watched the band play, and this bass player, man, he was a good player. I mean, and actually, he was a great player because he played most of the night using one hand. He had his drink and a cigarette in his right hand, and he was playing. So, and I was saying to myself, man, bro, you can imagine what this guy was doing if he used both his hands. So so he was, you know, on a break, I asked him if I could sit in, and he said, "Yeah, man, love for you to sit in." And I sat in and actually got the gig. Frank Morton was the band leader, and Walter Washington was the guitar player.
It was fate.
Yeah, it was fate.
It was fate.
I got the gig, and a few months later, playing that gig, and it was like a weekend kind of thing, a Friday and Saturday night gig, and I was me and Walter was after the club would be closed. Me and Walter would stay in there all night. Sometimes Rose, the owner, would just give us the keys and lock us in, you know, and say y'all could stay in there, and we would stay in there and we would play because at that time Walter played all this music, you know, but he didn't know what all those chords was he was playing. He just knew how to play them, you know, and I knew all those chords and I didn't know how to play those chords, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was teaching him the chords and I was learning these formulas from Walter. And Irvin Bannister, another local hero guitar player, saw me with Walter one night and offered me a gig on bass. Well, at the time, I was only playing a 3-string bass. I had 3 strings on that bass because I didn't know that I could go to Worldline's Music and buy the other tuning pack. Mm-hmm. I didn't know you could do that. And not that I thought I had the money to go do something like that, but Irvin, I was playing with Irvin for a few months when Art Neville followed Fats Domino from across the street to the Cindy Club where we were playing at, and they was hanging out at a club called Charlie's Corner, which was like a speakeasy kind of thing across the street. But there was no music. They didn't have their jukebox in there. And they came across the street. But Fats Domino came across. He had been doing it for a couple of times, you know. And he would come over and around 20 minutes, 30 minutes before we get off and play an hour. He would sit in and play for an hour. And so we would always end up, you know, playing an hour, you know, 45 minutes late, you know, because, you know, Fats wanted to play. So that's one night, Art came over with following Fats Domino, and he saw me playing. Now, Art and myself had a relationship earlier than that because Herbert Wing, Art used to call Herbert Wing when he had solo gigs, and he was, you know, want Herbert to come and be the, you know, be the guitar player to play solos behind him. Mm-hmm. And so Herbert was busy that night, this particular night, and he sent me the first time Art had ever seen me. And I was, you know, sent me as the guitar player. And I knew the music, But I was not a soloist. I was a rhythm guitar player. Mm-hmm. And every time I would turn around to him and take a solo, I said, no, I don't solo, man. And he would look at me like, man, what you mean you don't solo, bro? You don't take a solo. Yeah, I don't solo, man. And so that went on, you know, most of the evening. We had a 1 hour set he had to play. And you know, probably 5 or 6 times he turned around and looked at me and wanted to play a solo. And so he realized, he said, okay, I'm not going to ask him no more. So on my way, he was dropping me off at my house, and he told me, I said, man, you're the worst guitar player I ever seen. At that point, I mean, I knew who Art Neville was, and I figured to myself, I said, I'll never see this guy again, you know. It was a couple of years later at the Cindy Club, Art come in, I'm playing bass. And I'm playing a 3-string bass at that, not just playing bass, I'm playing a 3-string bass. And he saw me playing, and at the end of the gig, he told me, he said, man, that's the instrument you need to be playing. You want a gig. And he offered me to play a gig with him. And I might have played maybe a couple of months with him when he decided to tell me that I need to get that 4th string on that bass, or I was going to lose the gig. So Leo Nocentelli, Leo Nocentelli says, yeah, man, you can go to Worldlines and get that fixed. And they'll fix it for you. They're, oh, no kidding. So that's amazing. What happened. And we went from the nightcap, playing the nightcap like 3-4 nights a week. Until some business thing went down at the nightcap, and we ended up not playing the gig anymore. And then a few months later, Art came back to the band and told everybody, "I got us a gig on Bourbon Street." And we moved to the nightcap. We moved to the Ivanhoe.
Were you writing material? Were you playing originals at that time? Were you playing other New Orleans covers?
No.
What were those set lists?
We were a cover band.
You were a cover band.
A pure outrageous cover band that for the most part was very we wasn't playing those songs like the songs, you know. Mm-hmm. We had a very original approach to those songs, and Alan Toussaint had heard about us and he used to come to the nightcap and check us out. Because the doorman would always tell us and say, man, yeah, your boy Alan Toussaint was in here. You know, he wouldn't come in the club, all the way in the club. He would just hang out by the front door and just listen at a couple, you know, 3 or 4 songs, and then he'd leave. And he did the same thing when we was at the Ivanhoe. Just, you know, a year or so later, you know, he pretty much, you know, said, you know, something, you know, his rhythm section at that time, I'm not sure who all was in the band, but I knew that Walter Payton was the bass player. And Leo probably had been doing sessions with Alan, because Leo and Alan Toussaint had a relationship long before I even knew what Alan Toussaint was. And so he invited Art to come down and come to the studio. And we was like down there doing that audition for to do the Lee Dorsey sessions, and he liked what we were doing, and we did those sessions. I think we did a whole album, a few singles, and then. And after one of the sessions, Lee Dorsey session, Marshall C. Horn told us, I said, why don't y'all lay down a couple of tracks, you know, play something, you know. And that's how the first 4 songs we did was Sophisticated Sissy, which wasn't titled Sophisticated, it was called something, song, Instrumental 1, Instrumental 2, saying that, something like that.
Yep.
And so it was Sophisticated Sissy, Cordova, Sissy Strut, and C. Horn's Form.
amazing. The output that you guys had between 69 and 77, the Meters, Look at Pie Pie, Strutton, Cabbage Alley, Rejuvenation, which we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of, Fire on the Bayou, Trick Bag, New Directions. I mean, it's incredible output. And what always stood out to me was the production value of these records. And even to this day, I think that it rises to the top among some of the best arranged and produced music out there, and I think has influenced generations and of artists and fans and really bore this funk genre. How, when you think about kind of the baseline for Sissy and World Is Under the Weather, those to me are groundbreaking ways of thinking about songs and composition and the way that you know, the way that people can be introduced to the way that the bass can lead a certain, you know, a certain melody. I think that's what really stands out to me about a lot of those records. Was that the intent coming out of the gate?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, like one of the things with us is that, Leo and Zig were almost the primary songwriters in that band. Originally, so they were popping up with ideas, and we would just interpret those ideas. Quite a few of the of Leo's songs, the bass lines was dictated. Sort of like when we were doing the Alan Toussaint sessions, almost all of Alan's songs that I played on. My bass line is in his left hand.
Mm-hmm.
So like Leo came up with that concept.
Interesting.
Because he saw that worked. So he would come with a song, he would have the bass line in mind, except for the solo sections of the song is when I break away from the strict line of the bass. And then played those opening sections like the next Sissy Strut and Sophisticated Sissy, those middle parts that was my feeling of space and playing with the drums, you know. So that was but it was never, I don't think it was ever the intentions of there being the leader.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that was groundbreaking, and also just an entirely new way of perceiving a song, and also just to say those early shows, the ones that I've been able to go back and listen to and find in the archive, they're just burning. I mean, you guys are a super tight unit, and you're switching up the set lists a lot, you know, throughout your catalog. And your segues and transitions are flawless. Was that something you practiced, or did you guys just lock in because you had kind of this almost this telepathy because you had played together for so long?
Well, the original band did not do that as well as the Funky Meters did. The difference between the two bands was the drummer and the guitar player,
and Russell and Brian.
Zig was not that kind of player that wanted to play, you know, for 20 minutes and stuff without stopping. You know, he wanted to play a song, end it, play the next song, end it. You know, so you know it was, you know, the original band. Of course, the original band, we did a lot of jamming, you know, because a lot of our original songs were just 2.5 minutes long. And we were playing in 68, 69, we were playing 4-hour gigs, you know. So we were playing 3 1-hour sets, you know, so we were again leaning on some of our cover music, and as well as just, you know, jamming out on a back end of a song, you know, songs like the World's a Little Under the Weather, those kind of things came from jams, you know. Look at Pie Pie came from a jam in the inside of a vehicle. we were inside I think that was a Mercury station wagon, I believe that that Art had. And we were driving from driving on our way to Atlanta, and the engine, we blew a piston in the engine, and the engine the engine was making the sound. That's what the engine was saying, you know. And Zig started beating on the roof of the car and beating the drum pad on the roof of the car. And we went, you know, I don't know who started singing Bouncy Bounce Bounce, but I don't know, but all of a sudden, the three of us, Art was getting pissed because Zig was beating on the roof of the car. But we were singing Bouncy Bounce Bounce, and the car was just booking you on and back, you know. And we went all the way from wherever we was coming from, Virginia or something like that, to Atlanta, right straight into the Marlon LeFevre's family studio, and recorded Look a Pie Pie.
Epic. That's amazing. Each episode of The Jam features a toast and jam pairing. Today, in honor of George Porter Jr., we're offering a jammy yolk egg on toast with a dash of spicy chili sauce. Yum. One day, one of you guys gets a phone call from Paul McCartney about a party that's happening on the Queen Mary, and you guys get invited to play on there. If there was probably one party I ever wanted to be at in my entire life, that would probably be it. And obviously, as the story goes, Mick Jagger ends up at the party, and then you guys end up becoming the opening act for the Stones the following year. Talk me through what was happening on the Queen Mary and how that came to be, and that seemed to be a bit of a pivotal moment for the Meters.
Well, it did. The Meters got seen at that on that Queen Mary by the who's who of the industry.
Bill Graham was on the Queen Mary as well.
Oh yeah,
I've heard some epic stories about
Bill Graham's grandmother might have been on the boat.
Yeah,
there was like the who's who. Paul Williams, you know, I had a copy of the guest list. About 20 years ago, I found it, and all the print was just faded away. It was just, no! It was crazy, man. But outside of the fact that we got introduced to the Stones for the second time. And we had met McCartney and the Stones earlier, in Europe. We went over the seas and played. I think it was Dr. John. I think it was Professor Longhair. It was supposed to be Professor Longhair, the Meters, Snooks Eaglin, and I think maybe Earl King might have been on that too, or was supposed to be on it. We played the big theater in London. Albert Hall. Is it King Albert Hall? Yeah, I think something like that.
Royal Albert Hall.
Right. Yes, we played that hall, and after the gig, we were meeting and greeting. Our meet and greet was, we met everybody, all of the British royalties and the music industry, so it was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. They separated the Stones. The Stones kind of came later. The Beatles, Beatles came like through first. And I think I want to say it was everybody. It wasn't the whole band. I think it was just three of those guys. And
I know many of them have said that the Meters are one of their favorite bands ever.
McCartney was a big fan. A serious fan of the Meters. And we had a really wonderful relationship with Paul. myself and Era, but Paul and Linda at the time, you know, up until Marshall C. Horn released that pirated version of the Party on the Queen Mary, that album that was mastered from a cassette, and snuck, you know, I mean, you know, and did, and they released it, and it kind of, you know, I think it messed up the relationship with the Courtneys, because, you know, I mean, we had multi-track, they multi-tracked that gig.
Is that what forced the official release of it? Because there was a bootleg that ended up coming out. Is that, or had you?
No,
always...
the bootleg was the release.
The bootleg was the release.
Yeah, the master. I'm not sure if McCartney still had it or still have it.
Wow.
But you know, there was a 16
I never knew
track.
That. That's unbelievable.
There was a 16 track recording made that night of
yeah.
the show. And we walked away with a cassette copy of it. Three cassettes were made totally. Curtis Slavin had a copy of the thing. Ordinary had a copy, and I had a copy. But when the record came out, the version, everybody was looking, because we immediately, when you listen to the record, you can hear that wasn't from the master recording and the relationship that, you know, and McCartney was high, his relationship from his office about the fact that the record came out, that the recording was from a cassette. You know, and because the beginning of the vocals being sang on the lead verses of Fire on the Bayou, that you can hear the vocal coming through a microphone.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Not coming off the mixing desk. If it was mixed correctly, the vocal would have been more present. But the voices sounded like it was ambient. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And it was really terrible.
I never knew that backstory.
Yeah, but you know, it wasn't a great. It was a fun musical night, but if the recording was not as good as it could have been, if they would have went to McCartney and asked them, "Hey, man, can we get the 16 track master and mix this?" No, they went behind the guy's back and did that. And it's just. I finished his relationship with New Orleans total.
Let's talk for a second, you know, about the creation of the Funky Meters. I feel like that really garnered you guys a whole new audience. And then, you know, right alongside that, the creation of the Running Partners and the ability to be able to kind of build your audience, both with the Running Partners and the Funky Meters happening at both times. Certainly when I was living in New Orleans in the 90s, between 93 and 97, there was a healthy helping of both, you know, Running Partners shows and Funky Meter shows. And I feel like both bands were really in peak form at that time. And I remember a couple times you let us get a soundboard feed on those, and you know, for our DAT collection, and you know, so just to say, I mean, talk to me real quick about, I have to just call out Happy Song. Let's make the most of what our lives have to offer. Can you just give me a little of that for a moment? You know,
Bruce McDonald, guitar player, was in the band with. In 1980, called Joyride. That was actually my first solo band, Joyride.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it's after the original band had done, it was done, and Art had left, and Zig and Leo and myself were tried to keep playing, using another keyboard player, a guy named Mario Media. That didn't work out really well. And Willie West was, I think, was lead singing at that point. And for me, the band had gotten away from what we had done really so well, you know, and pretty much had abandoned all of our old instrumental songs. And none of those first three records, that stuff had went away, you know, totally went away. And, you know, and for me, that's where I thought that some of our best work was done in those old instrumental days, you know.
The
serious building block of the Meters' existence was in those first three records. When we started trying to start keeping up with the other, you know, with keeping up with the Joneses, as you say, you know, I totally understand, because I mean the songwriters in our band, they're wonderful writers, they're wonderful guys, and they have such, they wrote good songs, but the, you know, the fact that those songs didn't get put in the right places by management, you know, did us a disfavor, you know, because you know we never had a chance. After the Cabbage Alley record came out, I think musically, we went into the thing of wanting to wanting Ordinary to sing more, which why not? He's a wonderful singer. Why not? You know, and the songwriters were writing songs for Art to sing, but Art didn't like all of the songs that the songwriters were singing. That's when, you know, that's how Zig became a singer. You know. That's how he started singing Africa, because he wrote Africa for Art, and Art didn't want to do it, you know, and stuff. As well as some of those tracks that Leo's actually singing, that Leo wrote those songs for Artie to sing with, you know, Find Yourself, you know, that's a wonderful song. But those songs never got to see the airwaves because, you know, I just think our promoter, not the promoter, but our management at the time, you know, had A, lost control of what he called, what he thought he had control over, as actually our publishing and all that stuff. You know, he lost, he had to give up a piece of that, our publishing to us, because the band asked, you know, the band told him, say, we're not doing any more recording until we can keep our shit, you know, it's our publishing. Before then, all that instrumental stuff, the management owned all that. You know, we signed all that away. You know, and when we started making demands, you know, on that stuff in the early 70s, you know, I think management's idea about doing favors for us, you know, kind of went away. You know, so I don't think, you know, I just don't think the music ever got a real shot. Now, even though, you know, 30 years later, two record labels released packages of all that Meters stuff, and still those records didn't get the attention that they could have, you know, that, you know, any of the individual Meters would have hoped for. You know, we thought that maybe, you know, that when Warner Brothers released that compilation that they did, wow. We have a shot at this thing, you know. We got another shot at it. Then another label released the thing. I can't think of the name of it now. The label. So it's just like three albums, compilation records out there, almost 70 songs or something like that.
Yeah, the Funkify Your Life compilation is one of them, I think.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. You know, but those they just put out there. They're not promoted. You know, they're just stuck out there. You know, and you know, so and you know, and because there's not a band to go and push that. You know, play it and push it. You know, it goes unseen, unheard. You know, but the difference between what at that time when you were talking about. That's the funky in the 90s, that funky Meters.
Yeah.
We did a show. Leo Nocentelli, myself, Russell Batiste on drums, and we had a keyboard player named John Otan. It was like doing Jazz Fest. And I don't remember what year it was now, but RT came out to the gig. John Otan was playing the keyboards, and Art was tapping on his shoulder and said, "Hey, bro, let me play that."
Up the funk.
Up and play the song, you know, play the song, and get up and go back, sit back down in the corner, and John would come up and he'd call, you know, call the next song, and Art would tap John on the shoulder.
That's amazing.
that went on most of the night, you know. And John Otam told Leo, said, "Why don't you just pay him? Right? He played most of the gig, you know." So that kind of got us talking about maybe trying to play it together again. Zig reached out to Zig. And Zig said, absolutely not. He says, Russell's turn now. Let Russell take the day. Well, at that time, when it first started happening, Leo wanted to call the band The Meters. And because of the business, the relationship with the business part of The Meters,
yep,
it was, myself and Art thought that it would be better to rename the band, you know, and not have the business be the same. We can be playing the same music, but the business part of the music is be different. And so that's how the Funky Meters was born. And with Russell Batiste on drums. And
rest in peace, Russell.
Yeah, rest in peace. And about maybe that Leo stayed with that band for about maybe a year, close to a year. And he decided to move out to L.A. And that's how Brian Stokes became the guitarist in that band. And when that happened, the Funky Meters became more of a collaborative band because we started playing some of Brian Stokes' solo record songs in the Funky Meters set. We would play some Hendrix stuff. We were playing other stuff.
Yeah, you were playing Voodoo and Ohio, yeah, and all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
So, and that opened another audience base for us. Funky Meters did real well for those years.
Ohio and, Keep On Marching combo. Yeah.
I just did Jam Cruise and I sang Ohio for the first time.
Man.
And it went real well.
Those Funky Meter shows were epic. The House of Blues, Muddy Waters, all of those, obviously all of the tip shows, but they were really amazing shows. I remember John Popper sitting in with the Funky Meters over, I think it was Mardi Gras one year. And I also remember 426-96 when the Meters played just before Fish on the fairgrounds in New Orleans, being a great day. And also remember seeing you sit in with the Red Hot Chili Peppers on the fairgrounds. A handful of times, but that Funky Meters, I feel like you guys were a collaborative band and also were truly dedicated to the jam. And that period, I know, opened up your music to a whole new generation of fans. And a lot of the Meters fans that I know now were born out of that period of seeing the Funky Meters, whether that was in New Orleans, whether that was in Boulder at the Fox Theater or in New York at Tramps, et cetera. A lot of on New Year's Eve at Tramps, Meters, early show and late show.
Oh, my God. Those Tramps shows. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, and I think that, the other kind of touch point connective tissue that I want to hit on is your connection to the Grateful Dead. And I was lucky enough to be part of, Mickey Hart's team when you came and were part of the Mickey Hart band. And I know that you had done some stuff with Kimmock before. So I think, Mickey really trusted those sensibilities. And I actually remember one morning, I don't know if you remember this, you and I opened up the Mint Club in LA at like 8 o'clock in the morning and we had to audition drummers for Mickey's band. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah. I remember, yeah.
And I just remember you going, oh yeah, he'll do. He'll be all right. And so I think when you came into that, what was also amazing was that, I remember that summer tour getting Mickey to play songs like Fio. and some of the, and obviously he had already performed Ico and all those, you know, those songs, but some of the other Meters cuts seeped into the set list. So tell me about your connection to the Grateful Dead.
Well, I mean, that was my introduction to the Dead. Although I think probably 80%, maybe 70% of that music on that Mickey Hart's tour was Robert Hunter's music wrote for Mickey.
Yep,
it was wrote That's for right. that for that band.
The Gen song.
Yep. We weren't doing a whole lot of the Dead songs, and there were just a few. And I think the couple of ones that he wanted to add more to it, but I think that the young lady
Jen was
having trouble with being able to pull those songs off, and I don't know I don't know because I think we did Love Lights. But Mickey didn't particularly care for my version of the So we never did it again. We only did it one time.
Oh, wow.
You know, I kind of gave him grief about it. He was saying, I think he told me something about the Grateful Dead version. I said, no, I'm singing Bobby Blue Bland's And so the song disappeared from the set list.
Well, everybody get out there and support live music. A shout out to Porter's team, John Phillips, Boca Phil Egenthal, Denise Sullivan, and everybody who helps lift up the King of Funk, who's funkifying everybody's life, legendary bass player, collaborator, and all around great human, my friend of many decades. And thank you so much for being here, George Porter Jr.
You're right. Thank you. And I also like to send out a shout out to Johnny Ray, who does all of our media stuff, and David Stocker, who does, you know, our multimedia folks, you know, that take care of us, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you guys so much. See you next time. The Jam is hosted by Jonathan Shank, produced by RJB for Osiris Media, audio production by Matt Dwyer, recorded at Sony Music Studios in Culver City, music by Amar Sastry. Special thanks to Angel and Rob at Sony Studios, Emily Frost and Josh Winnick. Thanks for listening to The Jam, and see you next time.
Osiris.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
It is now 2024, and the choice is up to you. Do you listen to good podcasts, or do you listen to bad ones? Well, we've got a suggestion for you. How about you listen to a good podcast for the first time in your miserable life? I can think of one. Overnight Drive. Going strong. 11 years now. The podcast about nothing. Your favorite podcast's favorite podcast. Do you enjoy nothing? So do we. Why don't you come over and check it out and stop listening to other podcasts?